Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. On Monday, the U.S. Marine Corps Commandant, General David Berger, and the Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force, General C.Q. Brown, wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post calling for a new readiness model and for greater prioritization of resources to better prepare the nation for future threats. This call comes as the Biden administration is expected to make budget trade-offs on defense spending, expected to decline slightly over the coming years. Joining us to discuss the chief's thinking, readiness, and capability trade-offs are retired United States Air Force Lieutenant General Dave Deptula, the Dean of the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies, and retired United States Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, the Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at the Heritage Foundation think tank. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, Vago, it's a pleasure to be here to chat with you and Dakota.
Same. I mean, this is going to be a great conversation. Couldn't ask for better co-panelists on this. We're really looking forward to a dynamic interplay here.
Absolutely, guys. And I think you're the two right guys to be having this conversation with us. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Dave, why don't you start us off, right? You were vice commander of the Pacific Air Forces during your illustrious career. And one of the points that both General Berger and Brown are making is that effectively our focus on near-term availability is actually costing us, extending the life of legacy systems and actually costing us future readiness in terms of capability, right? That we're confusing availability with readiness. From the standpoint of somebody who used to do this as a general officer, are they right? Do we have the wrong readiness model? And if so, what is the right readiness model?
Well, let's talk about the basics of readiness. I would suggest to you that the chief and the commandant's focus on readiness as a priority is most appropriate if our military is going to meet the demands of our nation's national security strategy and facing the growing threats of China, Russia, and their proxies. But for your audience, the question out there is, what is this readiness thing? Many folks in the military tend to measure it in the context of what's known as mission capability rate. That's a measure of the proportion of a time a system is in a functioning condition to perform a mission. And in the Air Force, it's the time that an aircraft's available to perform its mission. But it's really much more than that. Simply put, readiness is the condition where our military forces have sufficient equipment, personnel, skills, proficiency, and the sustainment necessary to fight and win our nation's wars. Now, while the objective of improving readiness is essential given the security environment, what the chief and the commandant are raising is that part of readiness means having sufficient and capable forces to meet the anticipated threats. So I think what they're saying in their article, or at least my takeaway, is that you can have 100% readiness of a bunch of 1960s designed airplanes first built in the 1970s, but they won't do us much good against a pure adversary like China. And in the Air Force's case, aircraft recapitalization has been underfunded for years, and it's going to take a significant amount of time and money to correct that. For over 15 years, I've been talking about a geriatric Air Force, and it just gets older and older every day. So I think what is unique and what is very instructive or clever, if you will, I think it's a clever approach that they're instituting to move the discussion to developing capability for the future and how that's fundamental to meeting our future challenges. Because the character of the threats that we face is advancing such that the aged force structures that we have simply won't hack it.
Dakota, your sense on this, especially since, a lot of that focus is in terms, was hey, we've got to be able to fight tonight. And the point that they're making is that in that myopic focus, we're losing the ability to actually fight and win tomorrow.
So their op-ed, whether they intended it to do so or not, reveals an ugly truth. And that is that the United States has enjoyed 30 years of really uncontested ability to do whatever it wanted militarily anywhere in the world. Nobody was around in the 1990s. It was this unipolar moment. And then since 2001, we were conducting operations against non-state actors like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and Islamic State and whatnot, with no navies, no air forces, no artillery in a meaningful sense, no armor capability, right? I mean, these were all very close-in fights, and the U.S. could deploy anywhere. We could sustain operations. We could replace units completely uninterrupted, you know, from mobilization to ports of debarkation, where you receive them in theater and go on and do your business. Not to discount roadside bombs and sniper attacks and those sorts of things, but in terms of waging war, you could do whatever you wanted. And the size of the force needed was such that the totality of America's military could sustain those operations essentially indefinitely. I mean, that was the reality. Today, when you start assessing what would be required to contest any battle space against a major player like China or Russia, or even Iran, where you've got missiles involved, you do have naval power, you have fairly late generation aircraft, certainly very capable anti-aircraft defense systems. I mean, it's just a different world. So to Dave's point, you know, the average age of an Air Force fighter is 30 years old. The average age of an Air Force tanker aircraft, I think, is 50 plus, right? Yep. So you can't take something designed and built in the 70s, 80s, fielded in the 90s, what have you, and fly it against a latest generation S-400 system. I mean, you know, an integrated air defense system. It's just not going to work. And you can't presume that the U.S. Navy is going to sail something like 8,000 miles from the U.S. West Coast to conduct operations in the South China Sea, where you have limited access to ports. Our allies have seriously underinvested in their capabilities. And so if you look on a daily basis with 60 U.S. Navy ships deployed in the Western Pacific against 350 plus PLAN, you know, Chinese Navy ships, I mean, you're starting at a 6-to-1 disadvantage. So we've been able to ignore the reality of relatively small budgets. And by small, I mean not keeping pace with inflation and not keeping pace with the increasing costs of these primary platforms. That if you look back to the Vietnam War, it cost 16 times more than the rate of inflation to equip a U.S. soldier. It costs 5 times more the rate of inflation to field a replacement ship or a tank. And I believe it's something like 3 or 4 times as much for an aircraft. So just to keep pace with the reality of modern technologies, if you maintained a defense budget, even steady with inflation, you still have less and less purchasing power and will have a military that is smaller and smaller and older and older. So when, right. when Jim Mattis came in as SecDef, he was alarmed at the current state of combat readiness of the force that we currently have. And so again, this op-ed really reveals that, and that the service chiefs feel that they have to place more emphasis on future combat readiness and capabilities, even though that would mean shortchanging current readiness. So either they believe, and this is where I'm critical, that we really won't go to war in the next 10 years, right? And we can kind of take a pause on sustaining current capabilities in order to invest in the future, which is a bad bet, or they're having to sacrifice knowingly current capabilities in order to be prepared for some battle that may occur in the future. So, and the history of that is just horrific. You know, the Marines had a 1970s technology AAV, amphibious assault vehicle. It tried with the triple AV and then the EFE that was canceled. And they're just now fielding the amphibious combat vehicle, the ACV, right, in the year 2021, to replace a vehicle that was first introduced in the 1970s. So the U.S. does not have the luxury of picking one or the other. We have to do both, current and future, but our budget environment and the unwillingness of Congress to address risk as a reality has just put our services into this very uncomfortable situation.
Hey, Dakota, let me jump in there, if I may, and pick up on a couple of lines that were in this op-ed. One's in the first paragraph, and it says, quote, "The U.S. military must build a more lethal and modern force, strengthen international alliances and partnerships, and reform the department to improve performance and ability." Well, it's kind of interesting. A couple points. Last week, in a Forbes article entitled "Air Force, Don't Build Old Combat Aircraft," I wrote, quote, "The Air Force must direct its finite acquisition dollars toward technologies that yield the best value in an increasingly dangerous world." Kind of sounds like what the chief and the commandant are saying. Now they go on to state, and to pick up the line that you just talked about, quote, "Despite the National Defense Strategy's success in building a sense of urgency, it has not changed defense investment priorities at the scale or scope necessary to prepare the U.S. military for great power competition," unquote. Now, I'd tell you that's spot on. And the reason is because the defense budget today is driven by arbitrary allocation amounts, not the National Defense Strategy. And this is because there's a failure on the part of the Congress to acknowledge this. A couple of years ago, the National Defense Commission, Strategy Commission, explained today's circumstances pretty well when they concluded that America is very near the point of strategic insolvency, where its means are badly out of alignment with its ends. And given the looming threats alluded to by the chief and the commandant, this danger is very real today.
It's a failure to address what the reality of risk is. So when a uniformed representative from any of the services goes to testify before Congress, some member will say, well, what would happen if you didn't get this money or this program is canceled or what have you? And the person will carefully select the words and say, well, sir or ma'am, we will have to operate at increased risk. But nobody really ever defines what that means. And so you have, let's say, the Air Force, that for the last 2 years has put more money into research and development than it has into buying aircraft off of a hot production line. And yet it was the Air Force that said, to have the Air Force we need, they are dramatically short of squadrons. So the services are being forced into this very uncomfortable situation of, I cannot envision sustaining a fight against a peer competitor with 1980s technology. So I have to take risk at getting the next generation thing, you know, fielded as quickly as possible, right? And yet we're operating at these very small force levels with old technology, but you can't get rid of something that you currently have on the bet that its replacement might be fielded in the next 10 years. I mean, you open up this huge gap. So I think we're all in agreement that the future has to be addressed and we have to put money toward that, but at what risk to US national security? And I think we are accepting much too much risk because of an unwillingness to have a very blunt, frank discussion in the halls of Congress and the Pentagon and within the administration. And, you know, heaven help us with the pressures now of COVID response and all these other things that are going on. We have just gotten ourselves into a real difficult situation over the last 20 years.
I was one of the people who was skeptical about putting as much money toward readiness when we did. I would have preferred putting that money into modernization. Obviously, the U.S. Air Force has been expending a lot of resources on NGAD, the next generation air dominance aircraft, as well as the B-21 bomber and a bunch of other strategic priorities that remain highly classified. At the end of the day, was that a mistake on Mattis's part to direct as much resources to? Because it seems like that's in part what they're also pushing back against, right? This 80% readiness requirement is what is putting them in a pickle at the end of the day? Just really briefly, just want to get your each of your senses.
No, I try to allude to that right up front. Mission capable rate is not, let's put it this way. It's very easy to achieve an 80% mission capable rate. You just don't fly the airplanes. And now how does that translate to readiness? I mean, it affects the statistics. In other words, your airplanes won't break. So therefore they're quote ready to fly. But what about the training of the pilots? If the airplanes aren't flying, the pilots aren't training or maintaining their honed edge. So we got to move away from mission capable rate. It has to be a subjective judgment based on the leadership's understanding of all the elements that flow into readiness.
So what does that look like, right? They're talking about using artificial intelligence and big data and leveraging that. Each of the services has been doing that to a degree. Start us off with that. And then Dakota, want to get your sense on both of those questions, right? Was that drive toward readiness problematic? And does this AI-driven future, is that going to result in improvements? Dave, just finish off on that AI
part. Well, yeah. I mean, phrases like, you know, we recommend adding to readiness metrics, new layers of analysis, utilizing artificial intelligence to leverage the military's data-rich environment. Such a framework would enable military service chiefs to better prioritize investments in research, development, and future force design initiatives. What? That's jargon filled. It sounds trendy, but there's also a pragmatic view here. Are you buying modern jets or aren't you? You know, we don't need AI to know that. So said another way, don't make this too complex. And furthermore, Congress likely won't care about your AI derived answer.
Dakota?
I think it's great. I mean, I think we should be rightly skeptical of these sorts of things, you know, that it is a judgment call on readiness. You know, just because your truck works, your airplane flies, doesn't mean that the driver or the tank operator or the pilot knows what the heck they're doing. So again, I'll just use the Air Force as an example, because it's such a great service that if a pilot has been flying unopposed at 30,000 feet and dropping a precision guided munition on an enemy that has no ability to target or engage that airplane, and they fly a whole bunch of hours, right? I mean, just through the roof hours, are they really ready, you know, for combat flying against a competent enemy that can, you know, engage them in the sky and engage them from the ground, right? So it's the type of flying that goes along. AI isn't going to tell you that. I mean, you can put a guy in a simulator all you want to, but it's different when you're actually in the air. And if you have an engine flame out, you can't restart the simulation. So the cost of true readiness is working equipment, yes, but it's also funding the number of rounds that have to be shot, missiles launched, steaming days at sea where you're actually doing fleet types of tactical exercises, and pilots that are flying the gamut of types of missions, you know, low threats, high threats, dogfights, and whatever that might be, so that they are actually confident and competent in engaging at a higher order of battle. That's very, very expensive. So to meet 80% readiness metrics, Dave is absolutely right. You just don't operate your equipment and everything works, right? But the force is incompetent. So you can have a ready, incompetent force. And so I think that's what Mattis was really concerned about. I think the service chiefs have been concerned about that. The Army has directed many more iterations out of its national training centers to get more brigades pushed through that against an op four that is something other than an insurgent group, right? And so it's that kind of combat. I think this is what keeps General Berger up at night on the Marine Corps, is if we don't want to just cede the Western Pacific to China, then you have to be able to grapple with, you know, to operate inside their weapons engagement zone to really cause them a problem. Is that, you know, potential casualty intents? Absolutely. Is it risky? Well, that's the nature of war, you know, but you can't just stay away from the battlefield unless you're going to adopt a strangulation strategy, right? With some kind of peripheral defense of some type. So you have to get messy and get in there and figure out what works. And this is what the Marine Corps is doing. is going through all the simulations and the experimentation and the wargaming to figure out what a distributed operations force looks like. And you need different kinds of equipment. They will be dependent on what the Navy can also field. So to an issue that you frequently talk about, this jointness, what's the Navy doing? How does the Marine Corps help the Navy do what it's needing to do? What can air power provide in that? Not just in C4ISR and targeting, but munitions and all those sorts of things. So it's a big boys game out there. And we have just been avoiding the tough questions of what that really costs to be a global power that can do more than one thing in more than one place at a time.
Yeah, let me pick it up from there, because I think you make some excellent points. And to circle back to the chief and the commandant's paper op-ed, I think what they really have done is, at least my read of this, is they're trying to introduce the future into the readiness equation. So they're essentially saying that readiness also ties to the notion of ready to execute the mission from a capability perspective. And if I may, here's where the Air Force should be exceedingly worried here, given a bomber and a fighter force that are respectively just 13 and 20% stealthy. The force requires a massive capability reset, and that doesn't show on a flying hour program.
Right.
So you're not going to win against a peer adversary with 1970s or 60s design technologies, and the adversaries know that the U.S. is stretched in this technology area.
So the question, though, is right. I mean, they set up what their priorities are: AI-enabled remotely piloted aircraft, long-range precision, long-range penetrating strike, hypersonic weapons, better integrated base and missile defenses, truly joint all-domain command and control. So what do we give up in order to get this? Dakota, I know you've been writing a little bit about this, but Dave also want to get your sense. What do we give up to get to this better future? How do you make that trade-off, given that we think there is going to be budget pressure on the department?
Well, that's the problem, is that we're in a spot where it has to be this trade-off, right? And I still maintain you need both, right? So I think a real warning signal is when we think back to the 1990s, and because the Soviet Union was gone, you didn't have threat-based planning because there was no threat. It was a capabilities-based way of thinking. So what capability would I like to have? And there was a lot of money thrown at really goofy ideas that were attractive, but the science, the technology just wasn't there to make them a reality. You know, the future combat system, for example, for the Army. So great ideas. So my fear is, yes, AI holds potential. Yes, hypersonics hold potential. Robots with friendly faces that work well with humans hold potential, but they are not yet proven capabilities in an operational setting. So why would we want to hazard national security? So this is where I come back again to, you have to do both. You have to get real world combat readiness with the current force, and you have to make serious investments to bring in these new capabilities that'll be developed and evolved and proven, but you have to have kind of like a relief in place. You know, a unit doesn't come off the line until the replacement unit is actually there and ready to take up the standard and that mission. So to divest of old things before you have the new things fully in hand and really have a good idea of whether or not they're relevant in a combat setting, I think is foolhardy. So for me, it's a warning a gong here that the pressure needs to be put on Congress and the administration to fund both. Keep the current force lethal in real world combat credible readiness, as well as investing in the future, because tech doesn't slow down. You can't ignore the possibility of robots and artificial intelligence and all the directed energy and space-based weapons and those sorts of things. So we have to do both.
Well, let me jump in there with a big amen, brother, because Vago, your question, and I know you're asking the question for a very, very specific purpose, but it's one of an either or when, I side with Dakota here in the context of both. There is another option, though. You can give up that current force structure and you can dramatically increase the risk, and our adversaries aren't going to be blind to this, that we lose. And frankly, I'm getting more and more worried that it is going to take a significant military defeat to wake up the Congress and the American people to the fact that the only thing more expensive than a first-rate military is a second-rate military.
Right.
You know, from the Air Force's perspective, our fighter force is hard broke. It's aging. There's poor readiness in the traditional sense, a short of necessary upgrade money, small forces, fleets comparative to demand. We have currently seven types. If you count variants, we really need to slim the force down to about four main types. So there are things that the Air Force can do. I mean, a good case in point are the A-10s. Okay, that's full of emotion if you try to go after the force, but it could be managed in a reasonable fashion. But if you don't manage the current force from 281 down to 218, then you're not going to be able to source the F-35 positions to stand up a new F-35 wing. Okay. Well, and that's going to reduce our ability to deter aggression and adventurism in the South China Sea and in Europe. Congress, over to you. I mean, if you want to keep everything that currently is on the ramp, and prepare to the future, then you got to give us the money to do both.
Let me ask you both really quickly how each of the leaders, how the commandant and the chief are doing, given that they are very change-minded leaders. Dakota, why don't you start us off on how Dave Berger is doing, because he has sought to transform the force. There's pressure internally that hasn't wanted to transform quite the way that he wants. There's some pressure from the retired flag officers who think that this is problematic. A friend of mine was a sergeant, and he was like, wow, couldn't wrap his mind around the changes he's making. How's he doing? Is he going to get to where he wants to get to? And then Dave, the question is, right, CQ Brown started off last year with the incredible message, accelerate change or lose, to do exactly the same thing Dave Berger is doing, which is change the force. Dakota, start us off.
If you have to wait for everybody to agree with what needs to be done, you'll never get anything done. So I think General Berger is spot on in just bulldozing ahead against opposition from inside and opposition from outside. I mean, you know, you just got 1,000 people all with different opinions. And if you try to get complete consensus from everybody, you're going to be stuck right where you're at because nothing will ever change. So he's doing a great job at messaging. He's got the initiative, the pulpit, and he's just pushing ahead with what I think the Marine Corps really needs to be doing if the Marine Corps wants to continue to be a relevant force. If it can't do what General Berger is envisioning that it needs to do, that it might as well just resign itself to being, you know, embassy security guards, right? And doing the evening parade at 8th and I. So combat relevant is important. Combat relevant in the modern age and where everybody says that we're going to be going in the decisive theaters. It has to transform, and I think he is pushing ahead smartly to do that. And you also have to keep in mind that for any service chief, he's got a limited window of opportunity, right? You know, 3 to 4 years, and you just have to push ahead. And so I'm applauding what he's doing.
And I should have said, right, I mean, all his whole focus is Pacific war fighting. Dave, give us a sense on how CQ Brown is doing in his first 6 or so months on the job.
Well, I think, as you've already articulated, he's laid out a mantra of accelerate change or lose. He is in the process because he is early in the process. He's working to develop the details upon which he will actualize that statement. That will become more clear and more evident with the release of his posture statement. And frankly, I don't want to jump out in front of that or anticipate what it might be, except that the Air Force, as I mentioned earlier, is in a really bad spot. We, you know, as Dakota mentioned, the average age of our fighter force is 30 years. The youngest B-52 is 58 years old, for God's sake. Yes, it's a wonderful platform for carrying standoff weapons. But guess what? In a major theater contingency where you've got 100 to 200,000 aim points, standoff doesn't cut it, folks. You have to have penetrability. At the same time, just as our discussion has highlighted, you can't give up the current force structure, because as you wait for, you know, 10 years for the B-21 to get fully ensconced into the force, for NGAD to begin to show its capabilities. So there's a balance that needs to be achieved. And I think that's where you're going to see the chief come out in his first posture statement, is trying to balance giving the constraints that have been forced on, in his case, the Air Force, but all the services, trying to balance the exigencies of the present and yet meet the demands of the future. I can't overemphasize that the first responsibility of the government, as stated in the Constitution, is to provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare. It's not the other way around, but that's how our Congress today is acting.
Let me ask whichever one of you wants to take a bite of this. You mentioned all services, Dave. Why was this just Berger and Brown? Wouldn't this have been more powerful if it had been all five of the service chiefs instead of just two of them?
Bago, I think you may be reading too much of that in there. I think it is powerful the way it is. I mean, you don't have to have every service chief sign on the dotted. I mean, this wasn't a memorandum of agreement. It was a statement of their perspectives on including future capability into the notion of readiness. I don't think you'll see another service chief disagree with that. Right. I don't know why they all five didn't come together, whether it's scheduling or whatever. But I don't think it's anything significant to be read into the fact that the other three service chiefs didn't sign.
And we have to wrap there. Any last thought, Dakota?
2021 Index of U.S. Military Strength at heritage.org/military. We try to capture a lot of this, and it's a great reference, and pushing the commercial there.
And I'll second that notion, Dakota, from the Mitchell Institute. It is a wonderful document.
I will triple it, because I do think it's one of the most impressive works every year. And Dakota, you and your team do a terrific job on it. And thanks very much for doing it. Dave, Dakota, thanks very much. It's always an honor and pleasure having you both on. Thanks so much for joining us, and looking forward to having you guys back on again. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Have a great aerospace power kind of day.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.